From time immemorial, our ancestors have looked to the stars and wondered at their place in the cosmos. Humanity always has and always will be asking how our world works and why. In Utah and beyond, society produces more scientists than have ever been alive. We here at Utah Public Radio now invite you to join us in exploring the life, work, and findings of these extraordinary people by tuning into our weekly podcast hosted by UPR's science reporters. So please come along, and welcome to Science Utah.
The search for knowledge is in our genes.
Science brings out the best in us.
Time is but a stubborn illusion.
The chimpanzee is actually modifying a natural object to suit it to a specific purpose, thus making it.
We are all time travelers, journeying together into the future.
If we don't stop the destruction of our natural world, the only home any of us will ever know, nothing else will matter.
With Utah Public Radio, I'm Niall Clancy. To launch this new podcast, I figured we should start with something familiar to all Utahns, our state insect, the bee. We've got two stories for you today, one from Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, and one from Pinnacles National Park. Today, I'm joined in the studio by, who are you guys?
Okay, I'm Ashley Rohde. I am also a Utah Public Radio science reporter here, and I'm also a graduate student at Utah State University in the Wildland Resources Department.
What about you, Rachel Hager?
I'm Rachel Hager. I'm a science reporter with Utah Public Radio, and I'm also a graduate student in the Department of Watershed Sciences at Utah State University.
And Ashley, you happen to be our low-key bee expert.
Low-key, very low-key.
I guess we do have a lot of bee experts here, don't
we? I'm a bee expert in training.
Well, okay, thanks for joining us, guys. Why don't we talk about bees? So, Rachel, you reported a story about the insane diversity of bee species in Grand Escalante.
So, in Grand Escalante, there's the largest proportion of bees that they've ever found in a national monument. And so this just adds to the value of the national monument. And nobody had ever done an extensive study about what bees actually exist there. And this is the first study of its kind, and it really sets the precedent that when we're looking to protect these areas, we shouldn't just be looking at vegetation diversity, and we shouldn't just be looking at beautiful landscapes, but we should be looking at other values that these places bring to us.
Okay, well, let's give the story a listen.
When most people think of bees, they think of a honeybee. But there are hundreds and thousands of other bee species found in the United States. Olivia Carroll is an independent bee researcher whose recent work investigated how many bees and which bees live in Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument in southern Utah.
We found a lot of bees, so many bee species. It's kind of incredible. We found, I think the final tally is 660 bee species within the border of the former Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. So Utah has around 1,000. It's a good, 60-some-odd percent of the bee species that can be found in Utah also occur within that monument. And then another paper that was done a few years ago tallied up all the bees east of the Mississippi River and found around 770. So if you take all of the states east of the Mississippi River, they have about 100 more species than were found in just this tiny little monument that's about the size of Delaware. So we found a lot of bees, which was really exciting.
Because of this research, there is an increased understanding and quantitative value of the importance of this protected area for biodiversity. According to Carroll, part of what makes Grand Staircase Escalante a diverse hotspot for bees is the floral diversity and long growing season.
We do know in general that dry areas tend to have a lot more bees. There's species in flower from, say, March through November. But in addition to that, there's a lot of floral turnover. So the species that's blooming in March is very different from what flowering species will be blooming in April. And each time there's this turnover in the flowering species, there's also a turnover in the bees that are visiting them.
Bees are not just present in desert ecosystems. Carol encourages everyone to look for bees in their own backyard.
Bees are everywhere. They're super abundant. We're just not used to looking for them. I encourage people to go beyond just what we see in our national monuments and take a look right around their house, see what bees they can find.
With Utah Public Radio, I'm Rachel Hager.
Okay, Ashley, what are your thoughts on that story?
So it's actually not that surprising that Grand Escalante has such a large diversity of bees. And I think the reason, like, we notice that they're in Grand Escalante is because it is this national monument where people have this really wonderful opportunity to study bees. But really, any desert ecosystem in North America, but in other parts of the world too, has an incredible diversity of bees. Deserts hold some of the most species of bees all around the world. And so most of these bee species, or at least a lot of these bee species, are very specialized on certain groups of flowers, and they really only have an active season when those flowers are blooming, and the rest of the time they're hibernating or they're dormant. So deserts are really known for incredible bee diversity.
Okay, so it's basically that the flowers there are so specialized that it forces all the bees that pollinate them to also be super specialized.
Right, they have such harsh environments that they're living in where they really only have a short window when they can bloom, and that's usually right after a large precipitation event. And so as soon as those flowers are active, those bees have evolved to also be active during that time period.
And so is Pinnacles, is it kind of the same story? Is it, I don't even know much about Pinnacles. Is it a big deserty area?
It's a pretty small park relative to any of the other, like, national park or national monument areas that I've been to. And I was kind of surprised the first time I went there, because compared to the surrounding landscape, where I've also caught amazing diversity of bees, it's just this strange kind of alien-looking formation that's pretty small, and it looks like it's just plopped in the landscape of this relatively flat kind of deserty area. So it's a really special place just because of those rock formations, and I think that contributes to diversity of bees, but as well as everything else that lives there.
Absolutely. And so Pinnacles is the most recent national park in the United States, and it's really small. It's about 100 square miles, so it's about the size of a small city.
Okay, let's listen to the story.
Native bees contribute about $3 billion of pollination services to the U.S. agricultural system every year.
That was Joan Miners, a PhD student at the University of Florida in the School of Natural Resources and Environment. Miners and her Utah State University collaborators recently published work about a 17-year study on the biodiversity of native bee species in Pinnacles National Park, located in Central California.
We set up 10 different locations throughout the park that represented a variety of habitat types that we wanted to sample and catch anything we saw. So we're trying to kind of be like bee collecting robot, trying to just collect everything that we saw, not focus on any particular flower, so that we made sure we got the whole community of bees active in this area.
Pinnacles National Park is just over 100 square kilometers in size, so about the size of Provo City. Miners and her collaborators found that 450 bee species live within the confines of the park.
And when you look at the density of species per area, that's more species in a small area than has been found anywhere else.
And each of these unique bee species contributes to the diverse ecosystem in different ways.
Yeah, so each different type of bee is going to do things slightly differently. They're occupying different parts of the habitat, and they're also going to have slightly different pollinating behavior. So a really tiny bee might pollinate different flowers than a large bee would. Pinnacles has about 700 different species of wildflowers, and part of the reason for that is their native bee biodiversity, and vice versa. So you've got this cycle where really high floral diversity supports really high bee diversity, and vice versa.
Pinnacles National Park is the nation's newest national park, created in 2013 due in part to the native bee biodiversity found in this unique landscape. With Utah Public Radio, I'm Rachel Hager.
So is it a function of these are just two places that we've looked, or are these two places special? Or if we go, say, anywhere in New Mexico or Arizona or, you know, any of the desert, you know, Nevada, if we look there, are we likely to see just as many bee species?
They are really special places on the landscapes. by definition, that's why they have been designated that way. So high levels of diversity may be part of that. And that's, you know, one of the questions that I study is, how do we assess, especially with bee species that we don't know that much about, how do we assess whether they are in decline, whether their populations are stable, or if they're actually decreasing in abundance when we don't have the resources or the background knowledge to really know what their range was to begin with?
So let's shift gears a little bit and talk about, why do we care about bees?
Well, bees are very important for food crop production. They either produce or enhance the production of about 75% of our food crops. So we as human beings need them for that. But they also provide billions and billions of dollars of ecosystem services and natural systems that other animals can't provide and that plants need to be able to reproduce. So they're very important species to keep our communities and our ecosystems going.
And one of the big misconceptions about bees is when you say the word bee, the first thing that comes to mind is a big fluffy bumblebee. But what we're talking about are thousands of native, mostly solitary bees that live in small holes and twigs or under rocks and hibernate a lot of their life. And there are thousands of these types of species in North America and across the globe.
So why can't we just bring as many honeybees over here as we want and let them pollinate our crops? Why can't the native bees pollinate our crops, and why can't the honeybees pollinate native vegetation?
Well, they can, and they do. Because you can keep so many honeybees in such a confined area, it's really easy to kind of saturate a crop field with honeybees. So they're fairly efficient pollinators for crops that they didn't evolve with. So crops from North America aren't necessarily going to be pollinated extremely efficiently by honeybees. But because there are so darn many of them, overall, they do a pretty good job of pollinating our crops. And it's a way to ensure that your crops are going to be pollinated fully because you can control where they go. Now, this can potentially cause problems for native bees, and this is something that's kind of just now starting to be discussed, treating honeybees more as livestock than as pets or as an agricultural resource.
Does that mean we get to call beekeepers bee ranchers now if they're considered livestock? Because I want to be a bee rancher.
Well, you could be a bee rancher if you can.
You could coin the term yourself.
This podcast, we're officially coining the term bee rancher.
Yeah. And so, I mean, there is some resistance to considering them as livestock, and I think it's kind of a controversial issue, so I don't want to get myself in trouble here because they're not necessarily managed the way other livestock species are managed, but their impacts on native landscapes are still really being studied.
So historically, why is it that honeybees became the ones that became domesticated?
I think it has a lot to do with their social behavior, because that's a natural behavior. Human beings didn't breed or train honeybees to live in colonies. They do that anyway. And they didn't breed or train honeybees to produce honey, which most bees don't produce honey. I mean, that's a really valuable food crop.
Didn't they also used to use honey as a preservative?
Probably so.
Is it true that honey doesn't go bad? Is that a real fact?
I can't say that it never goes bad. I've heard anecdotally that it's been taken out of Egyptian tombs, and it's been fine. It's been crystallized, but it's been edible. I have a jar of honey in my house that I've had for 6 or 7 years. It's fine.
And hey, you haven't gotten botulism yet.
No, I'm good. Good to go.
Alive and kicking.
Yeah, so I think it's very well preserved. Long term, I wouldn't say that it's impossible to go bad, but I don't know. We could try.
Come back in 40, 50 years.
Well, we could like maybe culture some things in it and see how it goes.
I like that idea. Let's see if we can grow some harmful like E. coli or cyanobacteria on honey.
Yeah, I know someone who has some. Well, that's viral. Yeah. So I know someone who has laryngitis access. Right now. We could just ask her to goober on
it. Just give a good old cough there.
You know,
you guys can try that. I'll take a pass on that experiment.
Remember when we were in elementary school and they used to have us do handprints on cultures and then grow out what was on our hands? Did you ever do that?
Oh, no, we would do it with a cotton swab, and we used to be able to cotton swab all of these different things in the classroom, like the doorknob or the keyboard on the computer or somebody's marker.
Yeah.
And some of them were really gross.
Yuck. I'm sure there's some seriously harmful things we're cultivating in classrooms.
Well, you know that just based on, like, how sick children make their adult parents.
They hug and they kiss you and they put crayons in their mouth and then give it to you.
Yeah, kids are gross.
It's wonderful.
It's another stance we can take on the podcast.
Cute little incubators.
Yeah. All right, so I guess that's all we have time for this week. So thank you two for joining me, and tune in next week for another episode of Science Utah.
If I say curses, can you not use it?
I don't know. I haven't, like, asked them about it. You know, it's off the air.
As American Life does on, like, every other episode.
Yeah, they always give a disclaimer.
They do. And you can get the non-explicit version on iTunes.
Mm-hmm. If you're a pansy.
Don't air that part. Don't say we thought Miss American Life's a pansy.
No.
You hear that, Ira Glass? You're a pansy.
No, Ira, we were talking about you.
I was. Okay.
You're a delight.
Yeah, I know.